Welcome to Heart, a podcast about all things heart-related, presented by the Physicians of Advanced Cardiovascular Specialists. I'm your host, Susan Curtin. Today, we have Dr. Trey Baucom of Advanced Cardiovascular Specialists located in Shreveport, Louisiana, and we're discussing a COVID-19 update. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Baucom.
Thank you for having me, Susan.
So, Dr. Baucom, on March 20th, we released the first podcast where we discussed COVID-19. On the 23rd, Louisiana had a major shutdown. And it was very interesting. In reviewing that first podcast, I was amazed that your info, even in those early days, was spot on. And so what we'd like to discuss is now, over a month later, as the situation continues to evolve, you know, what we're learning about the virus. So are there any new symptoms of COVID-19?
There are. I appreciate your kind words. That is nice. It makes me feel better. I'm glad I wasn't too far off base. And they have recently released some new symptoms, which we in the medical field have been talking about for quite some time. And of course, we all know about shortness of breath, cough, and fever. That also can have chills or rigors. So if you have a fever, sometimes it's associated with involuntary shaking, and that's another symptom. Muscular pain, which is typical in viruses, but it's very pronounced in COVID-19. People have severe muscular pains. They'll have headaches and sore throat. But an interesting one is a lot of people have reported anosmia, their loss of taste and smell. And that seems to be a fairly consistent symptom in adults. And so I know when I read that, I went out and got a lemon to make sure I could still smell it. And unfortunately, that seems to persist in some people.
That's really interesting. And I think a lot of people now are very reticent to go to the doctor. So if they have these symptoms, what do they need to do?
So the advice as far as if you think you might have COVID-19 has not changed. If you call your doctor and tell them you have symptoms of it, we'll try to send you for drive-through testing. But we do still want people to stay at home if they think they have the infection. And it's really safe to stay at home unless you become very short of breath. The thing that really gets you put in the hospital and may get you put in the intensive care unit is if you become hypoxic, if your oxygen level falls. And you'll know that if you become very short of breath, and the shortness of breath just won't get better even when you rest. And we can measure that non-invasively with a thing called a pulse ox. But if your oxygen level is low, you need to be in the hospital. Short of that, you need to weather the storm at home. Drink plenty of fluids, medicine to keep your fever down, just the sort of standard virus infection advice, and avoid the hospital for COVID-19. Unfortunately, people are avoiding the hospital now for everything, and that's getting to be a problem.
So there's a lot of information floating around out there. Do we wear gloves? Do we wear masks? Does it help? Can you give us some guidelines?
Well, I think they've taken one of those out of our hands in a sense, because there's almost a mandate now about wearing a mask. I know if you're serving the public, you have to wear a mask now. And I think that's well-intentioned and certainly will not do any harm. The type of typical mask, homemade masks, and masks that you can purchase, just sort of cloth mask, are beneficial if you have an infection to keep you from spreading it. They have very limited capacity to keep you from inhaling a virus. That's just not how those masks work or what they were designed to do. Now, they will do a little bit of that. You do breathe some through the cloth, but a lot of the air goes around the corners of the mask, and so it can contain viral particles. But if you cough or sneeze while you're wearing the mask, it prevents those viral particles from getting out, and so it keeps you from infecting other people. The way that the masks work on large population groups is if you're in a crowd and everyone is wearing a mask, then it helps prevent the spread of the disease because the people that are asymptomatic carriers are no longer exhaling the virus out. The mask isn't really protecting you as much as keeping the virus with the people that have the virus. And that gets confusing, and particularly with the way these mandates come down. But the benefit to masks is really if everybody is wearing it because it keeps the people that have the infection, even if they don't know it, from infecting other people. So they're of limited use. Sometimes I think it's just the politicians and policymakers wanting to do something, and this was an easy thing to do. But there is some benefit. I don't want to make it sound like it's useless.
Is it important to wear a mask at all times? I see people wearing their masks in their cars while they're jogging.
Yeah, that does bring a smile to my face. If you're in your car alone, there's no reason for you to wear a mask. I saw someone the other day in a convertible wearing a mask. And I mean, I know people want to be protected. They want to do the right thing. And if you want to wear a mask, you know, you certainly can, and there is some benefit to it. But if you're alone, you do not need to be wearing a mask. And the gloves is even a more interesting issue. So people that are wearing disposable gloves, there might be a benefit to that, because if you're wearing gloves, you're less likely to rub your eyes and your face with your gloved hand. But if you're going to use disposable gloves, you have to think, how many times a day am I washing my hands? With me, it's got to be 50 or 60 times a day now. So I would have to have that many pair of disposable gloves if I'm going to use gloves instead of washing my hands. What makes a lot more sense is wash your hands. The virus cannot get in your body through the skin of your hands. It can't get into your body through your skin at all. Even if you have a cut, that is not how a virus gets into you. And so it makes much more sense, even if you're worried that your hands have become contaminated, to just wash them. If you wash them for 20 seconds, you've killed all the virus and you're safe. And to me, that makes a lot more sense than disposable gloves, which I now see on the ground all over the place. And so that's a separate problem. And so the mask has some benefit. The gloves have some benefit if you are handling very soiled materials. But just for incidental contact with surfaces or other people, just wash your hands as soon as you can afterwards, or use an antibacterial like Purell.
So I go to the grocery store, I can do my regular shopping with no gloves, as long as when I'm done with that, I wash my hands or use hand sanitizer.
Exactly. The most important thing is wash your hands before you touch your face. And we touch our faces a lot. But the virus cannot affect you unless you introduce it into your body through your eyes or your mouth or your nose.
Dr. Bauckham, we know there are COVID tests, but we also know there's a limited number of those COVID tests. What are you finding here in our area?
It's slowly getting better. And that has been frustrating for patients and especially for doctors. We do have some antibody tests now. And these get conflated a lot. There are a couple different kinds of tests. So there's a nasal swab, and that's called a polymerase chain reaction test. And what it does is it detects whether or not you have the virus in your nose. And so if you have the virus in your nose and you're sick, then you probably have COVID-19, although it is possible that you don't, that those are incidental findings. But the likelihood is that if you have the virus in your nasal passage and you're sick, then you have COVID. The blood test is testing for antibodies, and there are two different kinds. There's IgM and IgG. And IgM antibodies form immediately. It's your body's fast reaction to any kind of an infection. And so if you test positive for IgM, it means that you have either very recently been infected with COVID-19 or that you are still infected with COVID-19. However, when you develop IgG antibodies, that usually means that you are far enough into the infection that you are no longer infectious, you can't infect other people, or you're completely past the infection and you now have antibodies that hopefully will prevent further infections and can also be used as treatments for other patients. And so when people say, I went to get tested, now it's even more confusing than before, because it can be a test for the virus, it can be a test for an acute antibody or for a chronic antibody. But all those forms of testing are increasing in numbers. All across the country, more and more people get tested every day. In Louisiana, more people are being tested. We have all forms of those tests, but in limited supply. Although you hear stories about that, some places have a lot more than others. And so it's easy to get a test somewhere, but more difficult to get it. Even in the hospital, sometimes it's the most difficult place to get some of these tests, because we're testing patients to come in for procedures. And so we're saving the test for them, as opposed to just testing people who are curious, and we all are, about whether or not we've been exposed, whether or not we have it, and whether or not we are no longer at risk for it.
And I'm sure it's frustrating as well, because in some cases, the test you can get results back in an hour. In some cases, it's 10 days, right?
That's still, yep, that's it. And, you know, in the old days before COVID-19, if a doctor wrote, you know, stat on a test, it meant it was done immediately. And now it really comes down to the manufacturer of the kit and how it's done and how it gets batched, meaning when they put groups together. And so, unfortunately, a non-urgent test for COVID can still often take a week.
Now, for people who find that they have some level of immunity to COVID, because we're finding that as well, right?
Correct.
Are you immune forever?
No one knows. And that's one of those things that this, since the last podcast, there's so much information, but it is like trying to drink out of a fire hydrant. I mean, we get, you know, little fractions of studies and anecdotal studies about, you know, this or that cure for COVID and treatment for COVID and whether or not you have immunity. And then a study will come out saying, even people with antibodies aren't immune. No one knows. No one knows the answer to any of these questions. There's not been a single treatment go through the full realm of testing required to say it is a treatment or cure for COVID. There are several things that are showing very hopeful trends, clearly seem to be beneficial. But when you invent a medicine that you want to say is a cure or a treatment for a disease, you have to test it rigorously because placebo, just a sugar pill, works a third of the time. And so a medicine can appear to be working and simply having the placebo effect on the patient. You're giving them something that's not having any effect, but the patient's body is curing itself. And so it is very difficult to tell with anecdotal information. Someone comes in, we give them this medicine, they get better. You would assume that the medicine made them better, but you can't assume that. And I know it's frustrating for the public and for everyone, but it just takes time. You have to study thousands of patients, correlate the data, compare it to controls, meaning you picked thousands of people and did not treat them, and see who really got better. And so all of these remdesivir and all these medications, hydroxychloroquine, everything that you hear talked about, no one really knows yet. Although some of them are very hopeful that it's going to help, including convalescent plasma. The plasma of patients who have already had this and have antibodies clearly seems to be beneficial to sick patients. And there's history of that. I mean, that is a very common way that we've treated diseases. Even in the pre-antibiotic period, we knew that plasma would help people. And so it almost certainly is going to help some people. It won't be a cure. None of these things will probably be a cure. Viruses are just hard to cure. What you really want to do is treat them and then prevent them.
In relationship to the heart, are there any potential impacts to heart health that patients should be cognizant of after recovering from the virus?
Yeah, and that's another thing that's fascinating that's coming out. Once again, these are small studies or people have noticed trends treating these patients. And it appears that COVID-19, like many viruses, can affect the heart. It can also affect the blood vessels in different ways and can affect the clotting of blood. And so there's a higher incidence of strokes and heart attacks among certain COVID patients. And it's difficult to explain. We think COVID also attaches to some of the coagulation cascade that causes your blood to clot, but it's really too early to tell. But there definitely seems to be a trend of that. Viruses can directly affect your heart. We've known that for years. They can weaken your heart, cause a thing called cardiomyopathy. They can inflame your heart, that's called myocarditis, and they can precipitate heart attacks. And now there's recent, very new data that in children, it can cause inflammation in the coronary arteries, which can cause a heart attack in a child, but also can cause the blood vessel to be damaged down the road and give it a very characteristic appearance. We know that in Kawasaki's disease. And so COVID-19 is a very complicated virus that keeps showing us new things. But the overall trends, all this will come out in time. We'll figure out how much of this was really related to COVID-19, how much of it was incidental, you know, what the overall sort of rate of these things to happen, because sometimes these are very rare occurrences. But COVID-19 is so much in the media now that everything that happens we hear about.
And Doc, for someone who has recovered from COVID, what kind of symptoms should they look for when scheduling an appointment with their cardiologist?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it brings up a couple of points that I'd like to go over. We don't really know. We're worried, you know, as people get over COVID and while they're infected with COVID, like I was just mentioning, it can affect your blood vessels, it can affect your heart, it can affect your brain. Those seem to be rare, but significant. And so if you have any sudden new symptom, you feel like you've had a febrile illness, you feel like maybe you had COVID-19, or maybe even you tested positive and you know you had COVID-19, and you suddenly have some new symptom like chest pain, shortness of breath, difficulty speaking, cold and pain in a limb, arm, or leg, you need to let your doctor know immediately. And one of the big problems we're having with COVID-19, and one of the things I really wanted to talk about today, was people avoiding the doctor. This is getting to be an enormous problem worldwide. People are so focused on COVID-19, and the media has concerned people so much that they are now staying home when they should come to the doctor and they should come to the hospital. And every time I'm on call now, we're seeing examples of people that are having or have had heart attacks but stayed at home. And the survival of a heart attack depends on you getting very prompt care. We try to stop a heart attack within 90 minutes. If you come in having a heart attack, we go up your leg or through your wrist, go to the blocked blood vessel and try to open it. We try to do all that within 90 minutes because study after study has shown that the faster that you can resolve a heart attack, the better that patient is going to do long term. So the opposite of that is also true. If these patients stay home for hours into a heart attack, then they've done permanent damage to their heart that we can't get back. And unfortunately, we're seeing examples of that with heart attacks, strokes, and other illnesses, pancreatitis, gallbladder, appendicitis. All of these are potential lethal illnesses that people are ignoring the symptoms out of fear of COVID. And this is a very important message, I think. This may be the most important message of this update, is that people need to stop doing that. We know enough now to know that the overall risk of COVID appears to be less than 1%. It may be a little bit more than that, but it's going to be around 1%. The risk of dying from a heart attack in the United States with modern therapy is 5%. So people that rush to the hospital and get all the state-of-the-art care, there's still a 5% chance of risking dying from a heart attack. That's 5%. So people are staying home with an illness that has a 5% chance of killing them to avoid getting something that has a less than 1% chance of killing them. And I understand the fear, but I think we're at a point now where we know enough about COVID that if people get chest pain, stroke symptoms, severe abdominal pain, any new severe symptom, they need to call their doctor, go in and see their doctor. Try to avoid the emergency room if you can, but the emergency room is there for these emergencies. That's really why they're there. If you think you're having a heart attack, call 911, come in. If you're COVID positive, we'll deal with it. But people are harming themselves staying home. And the magnitude of that is becoming clear. The unexpected death rate in the United States has shot up. And so some of those people have probably died at home from COVID. However, it appears that a high percentage of them have stayed home and died of other things that were probably treatable had they come to the doctor. And we're getting to a point where the cure may be getting worse than the disease. And so I think it's time to people to realize that avoiding going to the hospital is not the most important thing. Your overall health is. And so that was the real message I wanted to get out, because like I said, this is becoming a bigger and bigger problem, and it's, you know, it needs to be addressed.
Right. So maintain those wellness visits. And if you have symptoms, call the doctor.
Absolutely. When in doubt, call your doctor and ask, and they'll give you advice.
What might hospital visits look like for cardiac emergencies in the foreseeable future?
It is amazing how life has changed in these few weeks. And so when you go in the hospital now, first of all, it's going to be almost empty because everybody that's non-COVID has avoided going to the hospital. The hospital has all sorts of barricades now and checkpoints. And so like when I went in the hospital today, I had to have my temperature checked twice. I was required to wear a mask. And you'll be checked periodically if you stay there long enough. And there's social distancing everywhere in the hospital now. You don't ever see more than one or two people even near each other. All of this is an attempt to mitigate the risk of people that are in the hospital and visitors to the hospital. And of course, there are very few visitors to the hospital. When we bring people in for a procedure now, they're really not allowed to have a loved one with them. And we'll go update the loved one separately. But when you're back getting your procedure and you're in recovery, you know, we used to let whole families come back there, you know, mom, dad, the kids, everybody. But now we don't anymore. We're keeping everyone separated, at least until this settles down. And so, you know, you still get the same care. It's still state of the art. We still treat everyone with compassion. But it is very difficult for them not to have their family around, and we're sympathetic to that. We'll call the family. We'll do whatever we can to ease their pain. But it is very painful to see people, particularly if they're terminally ill, not able to have their loved ones nearby. And that's been tough. But that is probably necessary. We have to have the hospitals not crowded with non-sick patients, non-sick people. Having just said, if you're sick, I want you to come to the hospital, but unfortunately, you won't be able to have many visitors. So the hospital and outpatient experience is very different. For instance, ACS never stops seeing patients. We've continued to see patients. I mean, heart patients can't wait forever. But to mitigate their risk, what we do is, of course, we screen you with questionnaire, then we screen you with temperature, and then we have you wait in your car and we text you when it's time to see the doctor. You come straight back and see the doctor, who will probably be wearing a mask and maybe goggles. And usually you're just in the room alone with the doctor. The nurse may come in or out to help with something, post orders, but usually it's just you and the doctor. And then we clean the room after every patient. And so the rate of patient flow is a lot slower now, but you can still get seen really by any doctor. And matter of fact, it's probably easier to get an appointment now, although the wait time is probably not great because, like I said, there's a lot more that goes into seeing the patient now than there was 8 weeks ago.
Right. And for post-emergency care, do you foresee a lot of similarities for cardiac rehab, for example? How has ACS adjusted? Are you moving to telemedicine and things like that?
Yeah, that's been tough too, particularly the loss of cardiac rehab. Hopefully that'll reopen soon because, you know, it's very beneficial to patients. And patients that have had to have bypass surgery, emergency valve surgery, all that, can't really get in rehab now. And so we just try to coach them on how to do as much exercise as they can at home on their own in quarantine, which is not a ton. And that's not great, but that's getting better. We have used telemedicine, and we always offer that to our patients, and particularly our out-of-town patients now. A lot of them will take us up on that. Or if they're just going over test results in anticipation of a procedure, some of those people prefer a telemedicine visit. It keeps them from having to come back into town, back into the doctor's office, just to have another procedure described to them. So we're using telemedicine. I'm not a big fan. It certainly has a place, but it's a different interaction with your patients. You can't really examine them. And so I don't love it, but it does provide, it does help in certain situations.
Right. Now, in our last conversation, you had some very hopeful messages as well. And I know there have been some unintended consequences of this pandemic. You know, do you have any new perspectives?
I definitely, yeah. And it's good news. I mean, you know, we know so much more now than we did 4 weeks ago. Like I said, it is like trying to drink out of a fire hydrant. The amount of data that's come out is mind-boggling. I really read about an hour every morning, and most of it is on this. But the overall trend is undeniably good. I think that this virus is sweeping across the world. It is definitely killing a lot of people, but it is not killing people at the rate that we initially were concerned about. Remember, at first we thought it might have a 20% mortality, certainly 3 to 4% mortality, and I think it's going to be less than that. Like I said, it's looking like it's going to be around 1%, maybe less. And you see numbers, you know, 0.03%, still up to 5.6%. So no one knows yet, but the trend is that it's not as lethal as we thought. And the lethality, like we talked in the first podcast, is clearly in elderly patients. And that's not great, but it's, you know, we sort of know who is at highest risk. Obese patients, high blood pressure, prediabetes, and age seem to be the big things that keep shaking out. Unfortunately for Louisiana, we have a very high incidence of hypertension and obesity. And so when people show you a statistic that says, well, in the hospital, 53% of the people with COVID that died had hypertension and 40% had diabetes. Well, that's the incidence of those diseases in Louisiana. And so, but those people clearly do worse. They have a worse outcome if they get the disease. And so we need to help try to protect those people. But that gets to another very important point I think we know now at this point in COVID is that people talk about a vaccine and everyone would love for there to be a vaccine, but the fastest vaccine that has ever gone from theory to application in man was 4 years, and that was the measles vaccine. We've been working on an AIDS vaccine since 1988 and still don't have it. We have never successfully made a vaccine for a coronavirus. And so we're all hopeful that there'll be a vaccine in the very near future, but I don't think that's realistic. I mean, it would be close to a miracle if we had a vaccine later this summer, like I hear some people talking about. However, we are slowly developing herd immunity. The whole point of all these mitigation steps that we took in America were to keep the hospital system from getting so overwhelmed that people died for lack of a ventilator or ICU bed. I think we have been successful in doing that, and it's time now to realize that the big hope for this is going to have to be herd immunity. This virus is going to have to sweep through the population to some extent. You know, young, healthy people will do fine. 80% of people in some studies don't get any symptoms at all. And we have to protect the elderly and those at higher risk. But as we get herd immunity, they will get some passive protection. Plus, there'll be that many more people to donate serum that can be used to treat the sick patients. Like I said, that's not a cure, but it does seem to be a very helpful treatment. And so all the more reason to start lessening the social guide, these restrictions that we have. I do think economies need to open back up, both because of the devastating effect of closing the economy, but because we have to let the virus run its course to some extent to achieve herd immunity. And I know that sounds extremely harsh, but it's not do that or protect everybody forever. Those aren't the two options. There's really not a choice other than that. And we've already mitigated it sufficiently to keep the hospital from becoming overwhelmed. So we've sort of done our job, and we have to sit back and realize, like the flu, like other illnesses, to some extent, this is going to have to run its course, but we'll be fine. 1% or less of our patients will die. Many people won't get sick at all. And a lot of people will get sick and then get better like they do with other illnesses. And there has been a little bit of hysteria with this disease. And it's time to back up a little bit from that and realize it's not the end of the world. It's not going to be the end of the world. And we can't ever be in a position where we make the cure worse than the disease. Doctors live by the Hippocratic Oath, but we also live by a motto called Primum non nocere, and that's Latin for first do no harm. So we have to be careful.
Well, that's, again, very uplifting, very hopeful. Thank you so much, Dr. Bakum.
Thank you for having me.
To learn more about advanced cardiovascular specialists, visit acsdoctors.com.